Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to another live edition of The Main Course. This is Joe Galarraga, engineer at Heritage Radio Network, and I'm here with Patrick Martins. We're going to do things a little bit differently today. We're going to start the show off with an opinion piece about National Farmers Day, so stay tuned, everybody.
Each year, there are several holidays that we all look forward to, such as Thanksgiving, Independence Day, Christmas, and more. And at each of these holidays, most people enjoy sitting down with their loved ones to enjoy a home-cooked meal. So how come no one has ever proposed a holiday to remember the people who feed us? Patrick Martins, founder of Heritage Foods USA, explains.
We demand that the President of the United States, with the full support of the United States Congress, declare a National Farmers Day to celebrate the people responsible for our agriculture, past, present, and future. There are only 11 federal holidays: Thanksgiving, Martin Luther King's birthday, President's Day, Memorial Day, Independence Day, and Veterans Day among them. But we need one more to celebrate and remember the people who feed us. Even the groundhog popping out of its hole and predicting the weather gets more play than our farmers. We propose that Farmers Day should occur on August 1st, the beginning of the slowest in spirit month of the year. It would be a day for farmers to come to the city and for city dwellers to travel to the farm. All in an effort for Americans to connect to the heroes behind our food supply. Everyone is welcome, from the people of Kansas and the Carolinas, Texas and Memphis, who party low and slow, to San Francisco vegans and all manners of omnivores. All of us will band together to celebrate the American farmer and Earth's bounty. Every culture we can think of has a harvest day except America. We have become too disconnected from the seasons, from a sense of place, from a time when foods were not available all year round. National Farmers Day will be a chance to taste new food and get closer to the earth. Most importantly, it's for our children, who should learn where their food comes from and to foster a curiosity and respect for what they eat. We see livestock competitions and farm dinners across the country. Trendy butter churners, urban farmers, chic butchers, and vanguard bakers basking in the glory of American tradition. This is a time to promote a new wave of agritourism, from Amish farms to amber waves of grain, orchard, ranches, and vineyards. And there shall be a federal mandate for the sun to shine. National Farmers Day is a day for hay rides, riding horses and goats pulling carts of children, egg tossing, potato sack racing, bobbing for apples, milking and petting animals, barn raisings, and pie eating contests. On Farmers Day, animals will parade down Fifth Avenue and cities will blossom into green markets. It's a time for feasting and for farmers to be honored at the restaurants where they sell their food. But to rebuild our food culture and guarantee that our children will grow up embracing healthy, natural food, we'll have to be vigilant to keep the industrial farm complex from co-opting the event as publicity for their corporate agriculture. Know that they will come in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are as ravening wolves. We are a nation raised up on the backs of our farmers, and National Farmers Day will celebrate the traditions of our very best foods while promoting a healthy future secured by American independent farmers, the hardest working people in the world.
Thanks for listening.
Joe? Joe, are you awake?
I'm awake.
Wow, that was
I'm actually wiping the tears away from my eyes right now.
I mean, I hope you're going to celebrate August 1st now after that awesome music that Dedrick put in the background of the piece. Dedrick did a great job, didn't
he? Yeah, Dedrick is an all-star.
It was a little bit unusual to open the show that way, but I'm so excited that that is an opinion piece that fits the 3 to 5 minute format that's going to be the primary format of the new facade of the Heritage Radio Network site. We're still going to, of course, have our fantastic 30 shows, and those are going to inspire a lot of the content, and they're going to be guests on a lot of these 3 to 5 minute pieces, the hosts are, but we're essentially dividing up the site into like food news categories. So pleasure, business, opinion, science and tech, news. These are going to be, you know, basic sections of our new website, and we're going to be producing 6 stories or so a day, every day, 5 days a week, and they're going to be about, you know, interesting things. The opinion piece I just did was a little bit light, but there'll be a lot of serious things on this new site as well, so we're really excited about it. Joe, are you excited?
I am way excited.
You sound excited. So we are going to take a break and then come back. We're recording live out of Roberto's Restaurant, 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm Patrick Martins, your host, and our guest after the break is Daniel Delaney, who is causing quite a stir with his 18-foot smoker and Texas barbecue style. We'll be back.
You are listening to Lung by Iggy Dean on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Stay tuned for more from the main course.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
Well, we are back. Actually, very sad news. S. Wallace Edwards Jr. passed away. That is Sam Edwards' father. Sam Edwards III's father and Sam Edwards IV's grandfather. And, you know, he was a guy that kept that 87-year tradition going before the current generation who runs it, Sam Edwards, you know, before he could take over. That was his father for decades and decades, keeping a old tradition that started out of making ham sandwiches on the local ferry. And has turned into, you know, probably America's greatest cured ham tradition, you know, done by an American in the American style where it's smoked. So he will be remembered and, you know, Godspeed to Sam and his family to get over this sad day as soon as possible. So we're thinking of you guys down there. So my guest today is Daniel Delaney. And on his website, he writes, "Hi, I'm Dan, and I love barbecue. My goal is to bring super-focused, brilliantly executed Central Texas-style Q to New York City."
You didn't tell me you stole that from the website.
Oh, yeah, no.
I'm so embarrassed now.
I'm like, it's all my own content until it goes live, and then he sees I'm just reading off his website. But tell us, why Central Texas-style? I mean, of all the barbecue traditions, Kansas City, North Carolina, all this, why did you go there?
I think it's the best.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, no disrespect to the other styles, but I think that there's a purity and a simplicity and a it's much more detailed, I think. You know, in the Carolinas, you see a lot of wood that's a lot newer, live wood, and they use burn barrels to create embers. And that's fine, but there's definitely a craft to the curing and the sourcing of wood. Mm-hmm. So that's not part of that vernacular much. And then as you go to Memphis, it's primarily being cooked over charcoal.
Now, is that, do you think, because wood is readily available in North Carolina, so they take it for granted, whereas in Texas and those vast expanses, there's not much forest land, so they're like put extra attention into where they source since it's not local?
Oh, no. I think that that's just not, I think that there's...
They are woods there.
Abundant, crazily abundant.
Yeah. Oh, really? So scratch that idea.
But that's funny that you say that, because the first time I went, I thought that it would be like a, you know, cartoon, like a, you know, Looney Tunes kind of tumbleweed. It's so lush. I had no clue.
It was interesting because I always remember that's why barbed wire ended up being important, because there was no way to keep the cattle in because there wasn't enough lumber to make fencing in those vast expanses. But maybe that wasn't Texas. That could have been Nebraska and places
Texas,
like that.
It's big. It has, you know, its own lot of forests and climates and it's also its own regions of barbecue. So,
what are its distinguishing characteristics, Texas, Central Texas, versus some of these other styles you just mentioned?
Well, all styles of barbecue are, I think, very much informed by, you know, the history and the heritage of the folks that settled in that area. And you have, I think, like three things that happen in Texas where you have... you have the cattle migration that goes through, and so historically, and we have this new influx of beef. It's a protein that wasn't as abundant. A lot of migrant workers from Africa, from
Germany, right? There are a lot of Germans.
Yes, that too. But you have migrant workers bringing the traditions of barbacoa up.
I see.
And then you have these Czech and German immigrants that had their traditions of. Well, I guess historically more pork focused, but meat markets and butchery shops selling. So you have this like this mix of in the central band in Texas, maybe along I-35 today.
Is that because the cattle went down that road more or less?
Well, you saw a lot of Germans and Czech folk settling down in that area. A lot of the names of towns are. Very German, and actually there are still neighborhoods where, like you go to the shopping mall and all the announcements are in English and German.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
Still.
So I think that you see with the style that we look at, it very much came out of grocery stores, meat markets, and it was a way of, I mean, barbecue has always been, it's always like, you know, the working class food, and usually it was a mode of preservation, of getting rid of the meat that took too long for somebody to cook at home, or that was turning and it would be smoked and cured, and so in this tradition you have German and Czech butchers and grocery store owners that had a large number of migrant workers coming in, and just they needed a hot meal, and took some of the traditions of that came up for barbacoa, of digging a hole and cooking, and the original sort of style of barbecue there was done in a dugout pit, and then when masonry sort of became more prevalent, and also the health requirements became more prevalent, they started building these brick pits above ground.
Hey, Joe, could you do a search for Austin, Texas on the Heritage Radio Network website and tell me the name of that great restaurant, and we had the owner call in, and he was our guest.
Oh, you're talking about the Salt Lick.
Salt Lick.
Ah, yeah, Salt Lick.
They had a famous pit, and they take you to the pit, and you see where it used to be, and I don't think that was ceramic, or that still looked like a pit, but maybe it wasn't the one that they use now, I guess.
Well, you know, everybody has their own thing. A lot of them are built out of, a lot of the like, places that we look to as the... You know, the grandfathers and so of this Central Texas style of barbecue. And often, it actually, like, if you trace it back, it comes to, like, two or three families, really. It's all very...
So its distinguishing characteristics are less sauce, more spice, right? Also, I mean, you don't just dump a bunch of sauce on Texas barbecue, do you?
Well, so the whole... A lot of places still do not serve sauce. We don't have sauce at the restaurant. That's more... That was just personal. I just don't... dig it, but
at least you don't make your own ketchup. That would be the worst.
we're getting there. It is South Williamsburg.
Use Heinz. Come on, please.
We see the, you know, these were butcher shops. They weren't restaurants. So they're smoking meat, and they're just, like, they have what they have. That's often saltine crackers. It's, you know, things that they could pickle, like jalapenos.
I saw some guy at Court Street Grocers. They're my buddies. They wrote seasonal pickles. What the hell does that mean?
I don't know.
Pickles go forever.
Yeah.
I got to talk to Matt and Eric about that. Anyway, sorry to interrupt. Seasonal pickles, yeah. They're forever.
So it's very basic. It's like hot sauce. Maybe they have... And the thing is, if you go to many of these places, the old school places, it's still like that. Many of them don't have very formulated sides at all, and they don't have sauce, and you get you're going to buy a link of sausage, or you're going to buy some brisket, take a stack of saltine crackers, some raw onion, some pickles, some jalapenos, maybe hit it with some, like, brought in hot sauce, and that's it.
Now, would people down there eat this way 7 days a week, lunch and dinner, or were there a lot of fruits and vegetables? I mean, is the diet more meat-based in a place like that central strip of Texas than it is in other places?
You mean currently?
Yeah, I mean, are people eating meat all the time there because it's just sold at every deli? And I just wonder if it's...
If people
were eating meat, or back when you're talking about, were they eating meat 28 times a week for lunch and dinner?
Well, I think that when you know, people were working 18 hours a day building railroads and herding cattle, you know, it was less about quinoa and more like, let's get some meat and, you know.
It's just funny. It's one of the only times in history where people would do that, right? I mean, meat was always a side, and then all of a sudden, somehow in certain places, it became the stuff of breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Yeah.
Big amounts.
Well, and it's also, I think it's very much like, you know, you have a lot of migration. So you didn't have communities where there's, I think, historically that much agriculture or the time to plant. And, you know, it's like cowboys, right? They're traveling with the jerky and whatever.
Tell us about the wood. I mean, you're talking about sourcing and craft when it comes to wood. So break that down for us.
So you have a lot of different types of wood that grow in Texas. Certainly, you know, people talk about mesquite. People talk about pecan. And oak is also really abundant throughout the United States. But definitely in Texas, you see more white oak growing and a bunch of different subspecies in the white oak family. The one that I think a lot of people talk about when they talk about barbecue is post. It got its name because it was used for putting, you know, it grows very straight, so they made posts out of it. It's what a lot of places use, but I think that really the nuances within white oak are quite hard to distinguish. So when you look at white oak, post oak, live oak, they're very similar in flavor. When we started, it's correct that I brought a lot of wood up from Texas.
But that's great. That's awesome.
I didn't really understand the trees also grow up here.
They do, but I mean, not all wood is the same. I mean, that's why people are like, well, of course, I hope you use the localist wood. You're like, no, not if it has a huge effect on the final product. You use the thing that makes the product the best.
Right. No. And I think that's what you're saying is sort of the philosophy that we've had from the beginning, which was, let's not sacrifice to partake in a trend. That said, you know, there are major ecological impacts of transporting giant things.
But not that much. I mean, you know, Kansas City to New York, I mean, that's a relatively small distance.
Right.
It's true that upstate New York is 14 hours less, but it's a small price to pay, you know,
sure,
for taste. And plus, you're not talking about what you choose to buy for your home 5 days a week. You're going to a restaurant.
Right, right.
So you really do need to have an epiphany of some sort. And the distance that food traveled is not an epiphany. It's what you experience in your mouth.
Well, ultimately, we stopped bringing wood up from Texas. While we were getting started, it was definitely like, I flew somebody down to fill up a U-Haul truck a few times and bring it up.
That's great.
But there are real serious federal implications around, like, they don't allow the transport of solid fuels over state lines. Like, you know, there's a major issue with pest control.
Wood's considered a fuel?
Yes. specifically, they don't want wood transported. You have a number
of ants and things like that.
I think more invasive species than ants, but yes, they and you know. So we eventually got to the point where we found a sourcing for wood up here that worked for us. I'm not opposed to the idea of going back to that, but I don't believe that what we have here is going to be so drastically different at this point from that. I don't know how.
Well, what does the wood give to a meat? I mean, it's
everything. Well, for us, so we are an anomaly in New York City, very much so. In Texas, it would be okay. So what? But we are very much the only ones in New York that cook commercially in like offset smokers, as you would see in Texas. We cook everything outdoors. We have no other fuel source but hardwood, and we go through a lot of it. We go through many cords a week.
How long is that girl going a day? You know, on an average weekday or weekend, whenever you cook.
It's an interesting thing, and the truth is that you know we've changed it almost every 2 weeks since we've started, as we start to shift and you know push a little harder on certain products, and you know when I started cooking this, it was that we were traveling to New Jersey, smoker was there, and the cook process was 18 hours for a brisket, and we've because of this idea that everybody has, which is low and slow. It's like such a famous little misleading term.
Diddy.
Yeah. It's horrible. I think it's a very horrible thing. It's silly, and it's something that has permeated everywhere and on every cooking network and whatnot.
So low and slow is wrong.
I think it's quite wrong. I think it's quite wrong.
Do not pick a pig, or do not take the swine before it's time. That's still true, isn't it?
I guess so. Yeah.
Okay, that's still true. Good.
I think that the low and slow idea makes sense, and culturally, it certainly makes sense. You know, people are tending a fire for a long time, drinking a beer. It's quite relaxing. It's treated too frequently as this blanket instruction for anything called barbecue. But not every protein needs slow cooking. Not every protein.
So, what are you high and dry? I mean, what do you do? I mean,
high and dry.
High and dry.
we have a cook cycle that starts off quite low for us. It starts at about 225 degrees. Some people would say that's hot, or that's what they cook their entire thing at. Mm. But our cook cycle takes us all the way up to about 360 degrees for brisket. It's different for each protein, but for brisket.
And in the new phase, I mean, is this grill on 20 hours a day, 5 days a week, or is it on 3 hours? I mean, how long does it?
It probably gets.
When are you pumping wood into it? Like, how often?
Every 15 minutes.
Every 15 minutes.
Yeah, while it's running, there's somebody that tends to it every 15, 20 minutes.
It's like a pasta. You got to keep stirring it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's probably more labor intensive than risotto, right? Because it's like. You're carrying tons of heavy wood.
So is that thing constantly on? Because or can you make a lot all at once and then it lasts for 2 or 3 days?
No. We don't. We don't believe in the idea of like freezing
leftovers,
or reheating or anything like that. It has a shelf life and
how long is that? Because then it goes to the place and is a la minute kind of heated, or it's in a low heater to begin with. Right?
We store in these pretty interesting, you know, every part of what we do was done because we had no instruction and we just, you know, we're winging it and tried to find solutions. We use these portable. We basically run the whole business like a catering operation. We cook off site. We bring things to the brisket town and to the smoke line every day, and we basically use catering equipment for everything. We have no proofing cabinets in the restaurant at all. Everything is portable. Everything can come in and out. And we use these boxes that hold the food, and they lose about 1 degree every 4 hours in temperature, so they're pretty insulated, and they're quite moist environments, so we don't see it really drying out very much. But no, what you're eating was cooked for. We don't reheat or heat in the restaurant.
Hmm. Yep. Where did you grow up? I mean, how did you get into barbecue?
I grew up in New Jersey, And it took me, it took me a while to be able to comfortably say that. I grew up in New Jersey, and I went to school in Philadelphia, did a kind of a design media degree, started making videos about food and doing a lot of podcasting, and I was traveling the country for that.
Is that where you learned about Web Hustle?
That's where I learned about Web Hustle.
Teach our listeners what you mean by Web Hustle.
Web Hustle. Web Hustle is, our business wouldn't be here without Web Hustle. It's completely driven by Web Hustle. Most of the funding that we raised for the restaurant came from Web Hustle.
But did you do, what's it called?
We built our own Kickstarter. Kind of built our own platform, sold meat ahead of time to raise money for the restaurant. We have a pretty intricate reservation system where people can redeem from their bank account of meat. We have a website called isthermeatleft.com where people can check on what we have. We have birthday meat where people can get free meat on their birthday. So we have a lot of these little things. But, no, you know, it's – you just got to be true to your core. And the core that I came from was this very kind of nerdy web digital background. It's how I learned about food, by traveling and making videos about it. So in this forum, it makes sense to have that as sort of a lifeblood in what we do.
What did your parents do?
Well, they still do. My mother is a saint. She's a, I guess for what, 35 something years, some very absurdly large amount of time. She's been a nurse. She's now the head of a oncology department in Englewood, New Jersey.
You'll never be as good as her, Daniel.
Never, never. My father owns a company, deals with the supply and sale of industrial chemicals.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. So, cool. So that's Web Hustle, and you do have to work it. I mean, they are actually very nice. They're elegant. They almost look like a letter. And you send out these, like, hi, I'm Dan, with an update.
It's very
fun
informal
to read. Yeah. I like reading it. And you do, you're doing Madison Square Eats.
Yeah, now? We started doing tacos at the restaurant, brisket breakfast tacos, a little while back. People love them. New York Mag said best breakfast in the city. Mm. Like, people were really excited about it. And then when we got our liquor license, we opted away from it because people just wanted to come and have barbecue, and the setup didn't allow for both. But, I actually just got another email this morning from like an angry customer who's been like jonesing now for 2 months for these tacos. So we're going to bring them back at Madison Square Eats. We're going to do some dirty ones, like some playful ones. And then we have some really huge changes coming to the business at large. Not that many that we're like ready to start to talk about, but I think that I can say that we're starting to lean away from the whole idea of counter service at large. It's something that we've been starting to do from the beginning. And I think
your goal has always been to open a full restaurant, right? Focused on creating barbecue cocktails and music.
Yeah, absolutely. And that we, you know, I think sometimes you wake up and everything that we're doing is great, but when you look at maybe where you what you thought the trajectory would look like, I don't know, a year ago, it's slightly different. Not bad, just slightly different. And so ultimately, I think we're starting to think more about, less about let's try and be like Texas, and more about let's realize that we're in the hospitality game, mm-hmm. and just try and make a better experience for the folks that come.
It's nice. So what was Brisket Lab? It was a recipe development series, and you're going to be doing it again, and they do events and stuff. I mean, tell us about that.
I didn't know we were doing it again. Maybe I guess if you say so, we'll have to then.
I'll get that angry guy to be like, where's Brisket Lab? And then you'll have to do it.
I brought the smoker up.
18 foot smoker.
Offset
Who
smoker.
Makes it?
It's an old propane tank.
Oh, it is.
It's a
old drum.
Yeah. It's,
So you bring it up,
brought it up, popped it in New Jersey, ton of wood, took over my parents' yard, had no clue what we were going to do. And we knew that we had like 5 points to cover, and we didn't have the money to just like buy tons of meat for practice. We also wanted people to be able to try what we were doing, because we wanted to cook a full load in the smoker, which is probably like 25 briskets, right? We wanted to really see what it was like to run that smoker.
25 briskets, about 250 pounds of meat, right?
Yeah.
More or less?
Yeah. Maybe a little more, closer to 300. So we wanted to see a full smoker load. We, you know, had no legality. We were completely rogue.
Could have burned the neighborhood down.
And we didn't want to be caught by the DOH at all. And so we had all these, like, criteria. And we also felt, you know, sometimes people flake in New York. We wanted to, like, have some accountability. And we ultimately found that the way that we could get there was that we created a web infrastructure. We kind of seeded it out, told people, like, we're starting this underground smoked meat club. Participate if you want, but space will be limited. Drummed up some energy and attention. And then we created a whole, like, sort of our own online ordering system where we put up, like, a bank of meat for sale, $25 a pound. People could buy as much or as little as they wanted. And it would just sort of live in a bank account until they went to redeem it at our events. Mm. And when we did this, we sold 3,200 pounds of brisket in about 48 hours online. Wow. So we went from having $0
to... How did you get this email list? Just over the years, family and friends?
No. So this is like tech talk 101. So we did this, we used this great platform called LaunchRock. It's available for free. Anybody can use it. It's great for when you're launching anything. And how it works is that somebody drops in their email address and you incentivize. So it's basically like a coming soon platform. I'm interested in this. I'm going to give you my email address. You let me know when you're open. But beyond that, it also gives you this wonderful, like, viral prompting. And in our model, we said, give us your email. Great. After they did that, we said, the person that tells the most of their friends about what we're doing and gets them to sign up gets a whole free brisket to themselves. Hmm. And
so
that was
like a raffle. I mean, in some way, you get something free if you...
It's like a Ponzi scheme, right? Ponzi,
yeah.
So
Bernie Madoff.
So we got like 3,600 email addresses in a week using this platform because people were really eager to compete, and we definitely instigated so that's how we generated the email list, and then we saw those conversions where people actually made the purchases.
Well, one thing I like about your barbecue is, you know, everyone, I'm always amazed, even in the highest halls of food writing, they'll never say what kind of meat it is. So they're like, you know, all the vegetables will go on for hours and where you have to get it. And this is, you want it like this. And when you squeeze it, it should be like this. And then the last thing is, and a 32-ounce flank steak. And you're just like, what? There's no detail there or anything. And so everyone's always competing using the exact same product. And I'm like, how different really is it going to be? But you put special attention to source the heritage stuff, the old breeds, local stuff for your events. You can act on a dime and figure something out and weave something in. So it is interesting that you're building your barbecue around like the Red Wattle Pig or, you know, the Piedmontese brisket. It's a very old school barbecue in that respect, and that you're really adding something new from the ingredient level. So sourcing's obviously been important to you. Now, a lot of barbecue people don't like the rare breeds because they're not lean enough, or they're not suited for barbecue, but you found the opposite.
Well, we don't use Piedmontese, but
right.
But we are using, I mean, we definitely, you know, we get our pork ribs from you.
And butts,
yeah. And maybe some other things coming soon. We'll talk. Mm-hmm. But we, it's much more about like what is going to be the best for barbecue, and we found that the ribs that like they're and the, it's working beautifully. And we've gone through a lot of, and it's a really interesting thing. There's this perception, I think, which is that, you know, oh, let's buy the Wagyu thing, the prime brisket, or the you know, and I think that. That's often really wrong in the case of barbecue. And it's like you have to play to how you're cooking. We found that, you know, the use of choice and these, like, it doesn't work very well. The use of prime. We use, like, this sort of top level of choice, and we find that fat renders a lot more beautifully. And, you know, I think that your sourcing, if you get caught up in the marketing of sourcing, you lose the opportunity to maybe find what's truly best for the palate and for your business.
Well, very good. Well, tell us a website, a Facebook. I mean, how do people keep track of the going-ons at Delaney Barbecue?
Well, I think that, I mean, definitely go to DelaneyBBQ.com, but
DelaneyBBQ.com.
I think that the most fun way for somebody to connect is if you go to birthdaymeat.com and give us your birthday, and then you'll be on our list, and you'll get free meat on your birthday, like at Dairy Queen or something.
Joe, could you log off birthdaymeat.com for one more second? We're about to wrap up the show. He's already on.
I'm sorry. I'm drooling.
So, well, Daniel, thank you for coming. I know how busy you are with Madison Square events, with all your restaurant and everything, and with all the changes going on. So thanks so much for being on.
Thank you for having me.
Very interesting. We are a member-based organization, so to help continue interesting program like today's, please become a member. $120 membership gives you a membership card for a year, and you get a beautiful HRN tote bag. So thanks for listening. Thanks to Joe Galarraga and also earlier to Dedrick for producing that opinion piece. Stay tuned for What Doesn't Kill You, hosted by Katie Kiefer, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.